From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There have been a lot of theories about what actually happened in Salem Village when a group of young girls started accusing innocent people of being witches. The historian Richard Francis figures it was a form of mass hysteria, but he's less interested in why things got out of hand as how leaders let it escalate and escalate. In his first book on the subject, Francis keyed on Samuel Sewall. He was the only judge to say he was sorry, to acknowledge he had been confounded by fear and anxiety. 5 years after all of this, he stood up in church and bowed his head while a minister read an apology he had written. Francis was so taken by the story, he wanted to go further than the limited facts from history, so he wrote a novel, and he's joining us today to talk about it after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years back, the biographer and historian Richard Francis wrote a book about Samuel Sewall. Sewall was a judge in Puritan New England, though more than a judge. He was also a merchant and a philosopher and an anti-slavery activist. He loved good company and good food. He was a good father. He was very disciplined about keeping a diary, so we know a lot about his life and what it was like to live in New England in those early days when the settlers believed they were creating this Christian utopia. It was the second generation of colonists who got caught up in a witch hunt, as you know, a literal witch hunt in 1692. And Francis's book really focuses on Sewall's apology for his part in the frenzy. 5 years after 20 people had been executed as witches, Sewall walked into his church in Boston to recant the guilty verdicts, and he asked his congregation for forgiveness. He was the only one of the 9 judges who had officiated in the trials to say he was sorry for what had happened. That book is called Judge Sewall's Apology, but Francis couldn't let the story go, so now he's written a novel. He stays true to the actual history, but a novel gives him freedom to imagine what some of the characters were thinking and feeling. That novel is called Crane Pond, and Richard Francis joined us recently from the BBC studio in Bath, England, to talk about it. We began with his first encounter with Judge Samuel Sewall.
It was in a bookstore, a very strange bookstore. It's a place called Hay on Wye, which is a little village kind of on the Welsh border. And some years ago, it was taken over by a very eccentric man who basically bought the village and made it the biggest, at the time, the biggest bookshop in the world, or at least so he claimed. What he would do is to buy books by the ton from all over the place, but particularly from America. And then he would sort them once so that the prices were kind of a bit arbitrary. And I went in there years and years ago, and I happened to come to this bookcase, which was full of colonial American texts, books published in the 17th century and the 18th century. None of them were priced. I went over to the counter, and there was some kind of kid, a student, you know, working there for the summer or whatever, and I said, how much would these cost? And he said, I don't know. They're quite old, aren't they? He said, in a tone of voice which meant that was a very bad deal.
Right.
How about £5 each?
Wow.
And so I went home with an original edition of Tom Paine, Rights of Man, and wow, loads of other things, including a book by Samuel Sewall, a book which I call Phenomena, which is the first word of a long, sentence-long title. Mm-hmm. And it's a book he wrote in 1697. And it's really, it's a very knotty, crabby kind of book, very, very difficult for a modern reader to find their way through it. But it basically consists in sort of prophesying the future redemption of the human race in America.
Yeah.
America is really, in a way, the promised land. And there is this sentence in the book, which comes near the end of it. It's one sentence, it's a very long sentence, but it is the most beautiful sentence you can possibly imagine. And it's certainly, I think, the loveliest thing written in the whole colonial period. It's evoking the beauties of America and its spiritual future. And I read this passage, which is a very famous passage. Of course, I was reading it in Sewell's original edition, which he would almost certainly himself have handled because he published it himself. And I had this extraordinary feeling of making contact with this man, and the generosity and the poetry of this sentence clashed so violently with the other thing I knew about him, which was that he was one of the judges of this, at the Salem witch trials 5 years before this book was published, that it kind of just started a question in my head. How does a man involved in that terrible miscarriage of justice also have this sort of soul to write this beautiful evocation of American destiny? And I think that really, that was the germ, really, of my later preoccupation with Samuel Sewall.
It's interesting how you say the sentence was his expression of faith in the Commonwealth of America. Faith, you say, in the past, but also faith in the potential for its future and its destiny.
Yeah.
But that seems like an important theme throughout the trials, the way Sewall is thinking about this. And Cotton Mather, of course, thought a lot about the fact that the Christian mission, the idea that this was going to be a pure theocracy, was faltering, was going to fail. And that seems like an important theme to thinking about what was going on at the time.
I think that's true. I mean, what's, I think, important to remember about the Salem trials is they occurred about a lifetime after the original European colonization of New England. And so it was the moment when that first generation of settlers were no longer there. And America was having to think of itself as a place voyaging through history, instead of simply a place where, you know, you could almost escape from history. You could escape from the history of Europe. You could escape from persecution. You could build a promised land, which in a sense would be kind of timeless. Suddenly, people were having to grapple with the fact that America had, because it already now had a past, it was logical that it would also have a future. And what form would that future take? And I think one of the things that is very, you know, part of everybody's experience is this tendency to sentimentalize and romanticize the past. Mm-hmm. And so this generation, the Sewall generation, the second generation, were looking back at their forefathers and thinking what wonderful, you know, wonderful ideals they had, what wonderful spirituality they had. And indeed, to some extent, they did. And of course, they were talking a good line. They were going to build a city on a hill and all that. But you know, life being what it is, none of these things kind of really held completely in terms of the original vision that people had of them. And all sorts of things had dogged the colonizers over the years, Indian wars, internecine struggles, you know, different sort of religious disagreements and so forth. Much like any other period of history, they were, you know, there were all sorts of problems and disputes and difficulties. And so I think this represents a moment of deep uncertainty where a certain vision is being supplanted. And what we see, I think, in the trials is really a Janus-like looking forward and backward, back towards a past that they wish they could reconstruct and reassert, and forward towards an uncertain future. And I think a lot of what happened in the trials relates to the sense that people had of being on the cusp of something. Mm.
There's this moment in the novel that you wrote where Giles Corey and his wife Martha have been accused of witchcraft, and Giles is going to be pressed to death. He's the only one killed this way. This was in September of,
1692.
Mm. And there's a moment when Sewall is approached by someone who says, you know, is this the right thing to be doing right now with Giles Corey? And he says that the court has to stand firm, that if it falters, it will be destroyed, and so will our city on a hill.
Yep.
Talk about that, because he says, everything he says is at stake.
Mm. I think, you know, I mean, that is obviously a reconstruction of my part,
right,
in the novel, in my fictional version of these events. But it does correspond to what is clear from the diaries, Sewall's own feeling of real crisis at this moment, because he was a very humane person. This was a very inhumane way of executing someone, pressing him to death. And the point about it and why they resorted to it was that basically what Giles Corey appears to have been doing, and of course one never will know his true motives because that was the whole point. He didn't say what they were.
He didn't speak.
But because he refused to acknowledge the court, he refused to cooperate, and he refused to plead. And I think this court, their deep uncertainty about their status as a country, as a colony, but a colony that wished to have some self-determining qualities, mm-hmm. It caught their uncertainty about this. If their court could be so disrespected and so confronted, then the institutions, which they were very aware were having to crank up out of nothing really, could fail. And that would be, you know, that would be a terrible crisis. I mean, I think the whole atmosphere was clouded by the fact that New England had lost its charter. The Massachusetts Bay Charter had gone into abeyance just before, a few years before the Salem crisis, the Salem witchcraft panic. That is to say, what happened was that the English authorities had decided that the colonials were taking too much on themselves and were becoming too independent of the mother country. Mm. And it was very like, in a way, a kind of dress rehearsal for what happened a century later when, you know, the colonials were kind of defying the mother country as best they could. And British officials were sent over to kind of run the place, mm-hmm. whereas the colonials had been used to running most of their own affairs themselves. There was huge resentment about that. Samuel Sewall himself, in the late 1680s, went to England in order to try to influence matters. And I think you need to kind of have a sense that of how fragile the institutions in New England were. You know, they didn't have a governor, mm-hmm. until the witchcraft affair had already begun. It was all suspended. Governor Phipps came over and then had to take things in hand and set up the court. So these things, you know, they didn't have, they weren't sort of secure edifices at all. And they were very easy, I think it was very easy in that atmosphere to sort of overreact and become very defensive.
When did Samuel Sewall first begin his diary? It was quite young when he first started, yes. writing everything down, it seems.
Yes, he was writing things from the time he was a college student, right the way through his life. So a few years are lost in his young adulthood, about 4 years are missing. But we have a very complete picture of his life. And I find this diary, I think it's sort of, people haven't fully taken on board how important a document it is. Yeah. It seems to me to give an extraordinary insight into the sensibilities of a Puritan, and really to rectify perhaps a kind of false picture many of us have or have had in the past of these severe, humorless, austere people. Who, you know, didn't really enjoy life and didn't want anybody else to enjoy life either. The sort of image that's been perhaps put forward by, say, Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Scarlet Letter. He kind of created an iconography of kind of grimness. But Sewall's diary gives us something different. Here we have a man who is extremely sociable, absolutely loved his friends and his family, worried about his children.
Loved food.
Loves food. I mean, he became a very large person.
Yes.
And he goes to great lengths talking about meals.
Yes.
And his meals are public occasions. They're either with his family or they're with his friends, or he's eating in a pub, in a tavern. You know, he has no inhibitions about this. He has no inhibitions about being a good father. I mean, a lot of scholars have said, for example, that the Puritans didn't really take much interest in their children because there was so much infant mortality that if they had got too affectionate with their children, they'd be heartbroken all the time. and B, because children were considered to be little sort of blank slates that basically had to be kind of coerced into adulthood as fast as possible. Mm. And really, the Diary of Sewell gives the lie to those pictures. He did love his children. He's totally preoccupied with them. He worries himself about them. He rejoices in their achievements. He's a family man.
Yeah.
And he's a social man. You know, he's gregarious. And I think that's a very important corrective somehow.
I like how he would write in Latin when he was trying to hide the sort of sexual things and the troubling parts of his diary from his wife or whoever might read it.
Yeah, what is clear from that is that on the whole he wasn't trying to conceal his diary, because you know, he wouldn't have taken trouble if it was under lock and key. He wouldn't have taken the trouble to actually write these bits in Latin. Right. What he does, in fact, he has a very, very happy relationship with his wife Hannah, mm-hmm. and several times during his life, he has nightmares in which he thinks she's dead, which is, I think, is a sort of nightmare that many people have. And describing these bad dreams, he felt that if his wife saw them, you know, it would make her unhappy or frightened. And so he put those in Latin to protect her from them.
You mention how the sort of hysteria over witches and the witch trials was a story in many ways about being invaded, about the colonization of the community, a community that was reassessing itself.
I think there's several interesting issues here. One is certainly this notion that there's a sort of reverse colonization going on. And this was actually quite clearly, deliberately put into the narrative by a number of people, one of whom was one of the ex-ministers from Salem, a man called Deodat Lawson, who actually gave a very influential sermon at the beginning of the crisis, in which he says that, you know, just as Salem, the port, was a great port of entry for the colonizers, perhaps I ought to explain that Salem Village was several miles inland from Salem Town. Salem Town was the port. Salem Village was a sort of little agricultural offshoot of the port, very poor, whereas the port was very wealthy. Mm. And it was here that, with all sorts of neighborly feuding and distrust going on, that the witchcraft was born. At any rate, he actually talks about the fact that the witchcraft can begin in the village because it doesn't need the sea, because obviously the witches come on sticks and so forth, and that it will be a very, very great invasion. They had a notion of a kind of crossover between the sort of paganism represented by witchcraft and the paganism as they saw it of the Native Americans, the Indians. And one of the features of the whole crisis was a notion that Indians were sort of skulking around. You know, Indians had swarthy skins, like the devil, as they imagined the devil to be. You know, this was a sort of bit of a crossover. In other words, what was really in their minds, I think, was all around us there are these pagan people, and we have this Christian little community in the middle of it. But within that community, there is this darkness spreading. And so naturally, there's a kind of an arc between the darkness within the community and the darkness, as they saw it, of these benighted people around them.
Yeah.
That's not the whole story, by the way. I mean, I think that, like most human affairs, there are always complications and contradictions. One of the things that astonished me was that when Harvard was set up in 1650, it was intended to be an Indian college, as well as a college for the children of the European colonizers. Both races were supposed to be learning about each other and living harmoniously. In fact, Sewell himself, you know, had an Algonquian Indian boy living with him, and he actually taught him for his sort of Harvard entrance. And this boy, who'd, you know, he spent his early childhood speaking Algonquian, ended up at Harvard, where he was considered to be a very fine Latin poet and a very good Greek one. So there was an impulse to befriend Native Americans, as well as a fear of them.
Well, Sewell thought that the Indians were the lost tribe. I mean, they basically were Jews who were going to be converted to Christianity, and that would bring about the millennium.
Yes, and he wasn't the only one who believed that. John Eliot, translator of the Bible into Algonquian, had this notion that the lost tribes of Israel had come to America, and they were the Native Americans. And various people put forward theories about the nature of Indian languages, and was it like Hebrew, mm-hmm. things of that sort. And Sewell talks himself about Indian customs, that they didn't like pigs. I think the main reason they didn't like pigs was that the colonists' pigs tended to root around and eat all the oysters and so forth. That the Indians liked to harvest, so they had a kind of resentment. But of course, for Sewell, that suggested they might be Jewish in origin, and they practiced circumcision, he said, and so forth. And so he had this notion that that the Indians were the lost tribes. And if that was the case, then in terms of sort of apocalyptic theory, the conversion of the Indians would mark the moment when the second coming happened. Because one has to say all along that the point was that the Indians had to be converted. There was right. no question of sort of accepting them and their culture as it was. But nevertheless, there was a kind of, because of this notion, somebody like Sewell actually had a great respect about for Native Americans and was very preoccupied by their welfare, as he was as far as black people were concerned as well. I mean, he became a commissioner of the New England Company, which was there as a sort of a missionary company to the Indians. He suggested Indians should be given their own land where Europeans would not be permitted to enter unless the Indians gave them permission and so on, reservations in effect. So he had some quite unexpected ideas, really. I mean, it's a very complicated business.
That's Richard Francis. He has two books on this subject, Judge Sewell's Apology and now the novel Crane Pond. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Richard Francis is joining us to talk about Samuel Sewell. He was one of the judges during the Salem witch hunt in 1692, when a kind of hysteria overtook Salem Village. When the dust cleared and everyone realized what a mistake they had made, it was Samuel Sewell who was the only judge to come forward and take responsibility for what had happened. Francis has written a history about Sewell and now a novel called Crane Pond, A Novel of Salem. I want to ask you about when you made the decision that you wanted to take Samuel Sewell and dramatize some of the details of his life. What was the part that you just didn't know enough about with the actual historical documents and made you want to create a novel?
I think there were two parts, if you like, that I didn't know enough about. One was quite simply what he felt about the Salem trials. Yeah. His voluminous diaries only devote 4 or 5 pages to them.
What do you make of that, by the way? That's fascinating.
Well, I don't think there's anything particularly significant necessarily in that, because he spent most of his life as a judge. He was also other things, a merchant, right. a printer, and so forth. People tended to be multifaceted in those days.
Yeah.
But he was a practicing judge for years and years and years, and he hardly ever mentions the trials that he's involved in.
But you call it the defining crisis of his life.
It is the defining crisis of his life, but it was a crisis that happened, so to speak, at work.
Yeah.
And his diary really is his other life. But anyway, that was precisely the point for me.
Yeah.
How to kind of fill in that gap, to find out what was going on in his mind during the trials, but also, in a more general way, to actually give myself the freedom to explore perhaps his emotional and psychological state in a more generally, because I think the thing about writing biography, well, I mean, there are various ways of writing biography, obviously. Some people, for example, mix fact and fiction quite freely, but I think perhaps precisely because I write biography and novels. I've always wanted to keep the two disciplines rather separate. And so if I quote dialogue in a biography, it has to be recorded somewhere. And clearly biography tends to be about people's public behaviour and public presence. The inner depths of a person are not really available to a biographer. I don't think I would have written a novel about Sewall if I hadn't written the biography first. I think I kind of wanted to do it one way and then the other.
Yeah.
But that implies I had both things in mind at the same time, and I didn't. But later I felt I could freely write a novel now because I've got the other version there. It's safe. It exists. And so I can allow myself a bit of latitude, knowing that the distortions, any distortions I make, will be, as it were, kind of disciplined by the architecture of the previous book. And I think that particularly the issues that struck me that were very important, which I mentioned in the biography, but I could explore much more fully in the novel, are the fact that Sewall was a parent who loved his children. And his children were, like most children, you know, quite a handful in many ways. In particular, he had a daughter called Betty who simply suffered from religious terrors and would become kind of hysterical and would believe that she was doomed and damned. This is quite a common Puritan problem because of the whole basis of Puritan religion and the notion of election, where God has already picked you to be a saint, i.e. to be saved, or not. And you can never know for sure whether he has or not. So obviously there's a lot of anxiety going on. And his daughter Betty, Elizabeth, was particularly prone to it. He's got this girl who could break down and become very, very upset at the drop of a hat. Then he encounters this group of girls, because that's how it started, how the witchcraft crisis starts, with a group of small girls of 8, 10-year-olds. Playing around and then going into hysterics and fits. And of course the crossover is obvious one, you know, there but for the grace of God his daughter could be one of those children, and it becomes therefore very important for him to take those children seriously, because he would take his daughter seriously, and also to in taking them seriously to kind of protect them, because if those girls are lying, which they in the end were, then they could themselves be accused, be seen as witches. You know, in basically what clearly was happening was that the children went out of control, they went hysterical, and then they were in danger of being accused of being in league with the devil or whatever, with some sort of terrible forces. And so they started accusing people of making them like that, yeah. i.e. witches. And so it was a transference of possible blame. And that sort of problem, that kind of issue, clearly could have applied to his own daughter. So you get a kind of an involvement that I felt needed exploring, a kind of personal dimension to the whole thing that was absolutely fascinating, but you couldn't quite winkle out in the form of a biography. I needed that latitude that a novel provides.
If I get this right, the historical Sewall didn't actually attend any of the hangings or the executions, but you put him there in the novel.
Well, he did attend the execution of Giles Corey, or at least he was very involved with it. Yes, he did, in fact, attend it.
The pressing,
The actual pressing to death. The most important group of hangings, which involved the hanging of the former minister, another former minister of Salem Village, George Burroughs, a very, very significant one. You know, because that was hanging a minister of religion. He couldn't attend that one because it was quite interesting, really. He was summoned by the Chief Justice, Stoughton, to go off to a small community called Watertown and help them settle a dispute about setting up a meeting house and appointing a minister. In that town, there was a great division. They couldn't decide where to put the meeting house in the town. And as a result, there was no point in appointing a minister. Now, this might just seem like a kind of routine thing to do, but it was timed quite carefully to avoid this execution where a minister of religion was being hanged. And I never thought that Sewall kind of cooked this up himself, but I think Stoughton, the head justice, who was quite a politically alert sort of person, probably did. The idea was, you know, there was dissension and spiritual crisis in Salem Village, and it led to this terrible thing where constantly witches were basically beating at the door of the minister. Almost all the witchcraft meetings, the meetings of these alleged witches, took place in a patch of land that belonged to the manse where Samuel Parris, the current minister, lived. And so it was as if the witchcraft observances were cheek by jowl with the ministry itself. And so there was this tremendous tension, you know, within the spiritual heart of the community. And it seems to me that it was kind of quite a good tactical manoeuvre for Stoughton to go off and tend to the spiritual affairs of another community which had sort of lost its way and was in a kind of limbo, as much as say, you know, this is what we really want to do. We really want to set communities right, not to persecute people. And it was an attempt to kind of diffuse what was clearly at that stage becoming a very provocative act, killing these people. There was a lot of unrest going on. Is it just a law of kind of acceleration that if you hang somebody for witchcraft, that person has friends and relations who are jolly sure that she or he wasn't a witch.
Yeah.
But they also fear that they might be caught up in the thing. And then the more you do that, the more people are frightened and disaffected by what you're doing, until eventually, by naming literally hundreds of witches, you get even more hundreds of people who are saying, this is just not odd, this is not true, this can't be happening. And so you get two kinds of laws of increase. One is the number of witches, and that the narratives of the witchcraft are always about transmission. They're always about a little yellow bird flying from person to person, witches moving around the countryside on sticks, you know, flying on sticks. They're always about mobility, about being able to move through space, and therefore to transmit and to create a kind of tremendous plague. But at the same time as that was happening, so was the reaction happening.
Yeah.
One of the things I hadn't realized until I started doing research was the fact that the community so quickly decided it had made a mistake.
Yeah.
By the autumn, the prevailing mood was, this is all a terrible mistake. And you get somebody like Thomas Brattle, yeah, who's the treasurer of Harvard. He writes a letter, which we have, although nobody knows who it was addressed to. My own personal theory is that it was addressed to the governor. Because what he does is he goes through the trials bit by bit, and he points out every fallacy, every failure to apply the law correctly, every false assumption about human nature. And this was in 1692. It was a letter that could have been written now. You know, I mean, it feels very, very modern. He just dismembers the whole trials.
There's a moment I wanted to actually, I'm not sure this is the actual letter, but I wanted to quote this because I found it striking. Brattle writes, "The court has consistently judged people by their surface, but we can't expect to bring souls out into the light of day like so many fish being hooked out of the sea.
Yeah.
People are forever mysterious. I'm even a mystery to myself." Now, were you quoting him there, or were you imagining
that's
Brattle
from the novel, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is slightly, I've kind of jazzed it up a little bit. But basically, he does talk in the letter about, for example, how impossible it is to know anybody's heart.
Yeah.
Now, this relates to one of the pivotal moments in the trials when
Rebecca Nurse
who had most appalling experience and was indeed hanged. She was confronted by the accusing children who were pointing to her and saying, you know, you are making us suffer, you are making us feel these terrible sensations, these pins sticking in us and all the rest of it. And she did cry, and the interrogator says, you know, why didn't you cry when you saw those children suffering? It must mean that you're the witch, you're causing the suffering. And she simply says, you do not know my heart.
Yeah.
And Brattle picks this phrase, this sentence up, and says, you know, people can weep when for nothing, or even when they're happy, and people can actually show no emotion when they're actually distraught. And in fact, he's not the only one who picks that up. Samuel Willard, Sewall's own minister, also quotes that in his book about the trials. That sentence is one that really rang a bell with people. And I think the reason it rang a bell was that it catches another important issue that really the trials are about. There was a notion that people were kind of almost like puppets, you know, doing good or bad in the world, either controlled by God or by Satan. A kind of notion that human life was almost allegorical, good and evil. And this was being supplanted, I think, by a notion that there were hidden depths, that people were unpredictable, that people couldn't, you know, you couldn't jump to conclusions about what made people tick.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the lessons of the trials. And I think it was a lesson that Sewall learned. You know, towards the end of his life, when his wife died, and in those days, you were kind of not really expected to be a singleton, you know.
It was untidy.
It was untidy. But I think probably the practical reason was that you could be a burden on the community. So it's much better to have a spouse looking after you.
Right.
Anyway, he was very quickly, even though he had a very long and happy marriage, he was very quickly sort of shown the widow's pew in the meeting house where all the widows sat in a line. And kind of he dated them. It was a bit like, you know, sort of internet dating or something. He sort of dated them, or speed dating.
Right.
He dated them sort of in sequence. And his counts of his courtships are wonderful. And people often mock them. And there is a comic side to them, because he kind of goes, he talks in incredible detail about what their clothes look like, whether their clothes are clean or not, because clean clothes were obviously at a premium in that community. You know, it was a very special occasion indeed when you wore a clean dress. And how many, you know, what sweets he bought, what sweetmeats, and how the furniture was arranged, whether the lady had put a sort of barrier between him and her or not. And basically what we have there is a kind of psychological encounter, a kind of these women, he doesn't make assumptions about them. He's trying to interpret them. Mm-hmm. He's trying to decode their behavior.
Which was entirely new. Just, I mean,
which
that's
was,
an important
It seems
point,
to be
right?
entirely new.
Yeah.
There's nobody else at that period who wrote in that way in New England. I mean, and it seemed, and I can't help but feel that was a lesson from the trials, that that he'd learned that you shouldn't just judge from appearances, that what may be, appear to be happening in front of your eyes may not be really what's happening deep down. I mean, it's important to remember that the trials had to enact witchcraft.
Right.
They weren't about witchcraft, they enacted it. That is to say, to actually find somebody guilty of a crime, you had to have at least two witnesses to the crime. Now, if somebody just goes up to a magistrate or a constable and says, I've been haunted, a witch has been persecuting me, who is the witness? Mm-hmm. Is by definition, you haven't got one. So what you basically had to, what had to happen in the preliminary hearings was that children, and then the adults who joined in accusing at a later stage, they would show their suffering and point to the people who are causing their suffering in front of the justices. And so there were then witnesses to the event. So you're watching a kind of stage play taking place. And this is a community that didn't have theatre. And so people weren't used to watching performances. And they were performances.
Right.
And so he was watching this drama, and along with everybody else, and interpreting it in a very literal way. Years later, when he's courting his ladies, he is watching a different kind of domestic drama and interpreting it very, very much more cautiously. And I think that's a huge movement towards, you know, a sort of belief in looking at externals, and to the beginning of a sort of modern way of looking at people as having psychological depths that aren't necessarily available to you.
That's Richard Francis. His latest book is Crane Pond, a novel of Salem. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with biographer and historian Richard Francis about his new novel, Crane Pond. He makes this very public apology, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But do you think you have a good sense of when he starts raising questions about what's happening? I mean, Sewell himself. There is a moment, I have to say, in the novel I wanted to ask you about. This brings us back to Giles Corey, who was pressed to death. And there's this, you put Cotton Mather there at the execution. He's there to witness this new form of execution in the country. Mm. Feels like he needs to be there. And Sewell's, of course, there as well. And he hears this, I have to say, this may sound a bit grotesque, but Sewell hears this faint sound from Giles Corey, and he realizes it's his ribs collapsing. Yeah. And you write this, that a sudden tiny movement snags his attention. Now he's looking out of his eyes once more, seeing, in fact, with a sudden clarity, as if he's put on a pair of spectacles. Would you just talk about what you're imagining is happening to Sewell as he's there at this brutal execution?
The context of that is he's trying, this is in the novel, he's trying to sort of not see what he's seeing.
Yeah.
In the way one can almost do, sort of, as it were, move deep into one's head, away from one's eyes.
Right.
And then it comes into focus. There's a horrible moment, which actually is recorded, not by Sewell, but by somebody else, in which Giles Corey's tongue is forced by the pressure out of his mouth and is flipped back into his mouth by the sheriff with his cane. Which is a ghastly moment. But clearly, as a humane man, this must have been an appalling experience for Sewell. And, well, it was. I mean, he makes it clear in his diary it was. And he was very, very upset by it. And then he gets a letter. And the letter is from the father of the chief accuser, the 11-year-old Ann Putnam, who accused, I think, 70 people over all the trials of witchcraft. And her father writes and says, "My daughter's had a dream, and it's proved that Giles Corey, many years ago, beat a man to death," which actually is true. He did. He was found not guilty, and it wasn't brought up in the context of the trials at all. But Sewell manages to convince himself, and he does talk about this, that this meant that in some ways there were... Giles Corey deserved his fate. Mm-hmm. And he kind of tries to settle himself with that thought. And over the next few years, he, every now and again you can sense his gathering unease. Mm-hmm. And he associates the various misfortunes that take place in the community, including droughts and bad harvests and so on, economic crises. He associates those with the sense that the community has lost its way and has made a terrible mistake. And then in 1696, his son, they have family devotions where everybody takes it in turn to read a passage from the Bible at mealtimes and so on. And his son reads this a piece from Matthew about if you had known that they were guiltless, everything would have been different sort of thing. And... it strikes him that this passage is really about his own guilt and about the guiltlessness of the people who are executed. And this is one of the factors that brings him to make his public statement in January 1697, when he stands up in his meeting house while he gets the minister, Samuel Willard, to read his apology. Yeah. In which he takes the whole blame for the events that happened on himself.
Bows his head. It's almost like a performance that he's enacting.
Yeah. Yes, he bows his head to the audience, as you say, it's like a performance, to the fellow congregants. And he makes his public thing. What I was able to do in the novel, which I didn't feel I could fully do in the biography, was to kind of contextualize this experience a bit. A quotation Sewell makes in his youth is from a man called, puts in his diary, a man called John Owen, who was the chaplain to Oliver Cromwell, a very prominent Puritan, therefore, and the man who actually got John Bunyan released from jail where he was writing Pilgrim's Progress, which Sewell published, by the way. Any rate, John Owen once said that you should always live your life on the assumption that you've been elected, and that it may be that actually everybody is elected. And of course, this is an extraordinary thought, it seems to me, that, you know, this whole severe religion where people were going around not knowing whether God had elected them to heaven, and having to sort of prove to themselves and to their community that they were worthy of election by doing good works, but they couldn't earn election through the good works. They could only sort of prove it. They could only, to use their words, justify it. But if everybody's been elected, that puts everybody on an even keel. And I think that's a very kind, I'm sure that that was something that stayed in Sewell's mind, this notion that actually it's a more generous setup than you might think, that election belongs to everybody. Mm. You can perhaps betray it and sort of de-elect yourself, but in fact, otherwise, you'll be saved. And I have him saying this to his daughter, and it's quite likely he would have done, the daughter that had these religious terrors. Yeah. And she, of course, comes back and says it to him when he's getting a dark night of the soul. He has also a fear that when he made his act his public statement for membership of his church when he was a young man, he forgot to confess his sins. And I mean, he does say this in his diary. And I think I wondered if he had this notion that somehow he was always slightly outside the meeting house, that he'd forgotten to confess and therefore wasn't a full member of the church. And he actually describes at one point wishing he could see Jesus there and never quite glimpsing him. And it struck me that maybe he, behind his apology was this notion that now he's confessing his sins, the biggest sin you can imagine, and that this might get him entrance back into the community, the spiritual community. Although in my novel, I kind of suggest that actually it proves sort of slightly disappointing in the way, you know, when you have a big occasion in your life and it doesn't quite have the impact that you sort of expected it to. And he walks out and he still feels an outsider. He's upset a lot of people, upset fellow judges. He's the only judge who admits it was all a mistake. Right. There were 9 judges altogether.
Stoughton doesn't invite him to a dinner party.
Stoughton doesn't invite him to a dinner party for the judges. And it kind of looks as if that dinner party was staged simply in order not to invite Sewell to it, so that he would feel ostracized. And basically, I suppose, what I'm doing in the novel, but I don't think it's an illegitimate thing to do, is build a head of steam between that moment in January when he makes his confession, but maybe it's not completely satisfying, to the moment later in the summer when he writes this great paean in praise of the beauty of America and this hopes for the future of America. You know, that somehow during that period, he somehow reorganized his mind a little bit.
Yeah.
And what I kind of want to suggest slightly is the feeling that it's a more generous and more open sort of religion that he subscribes to. And that when he goes to Watertown to help settle their issues, and he makes the suggestion they should just have religion in the open air if necessary. Appoint a minister, but without building a meeting house, you know, to start with.
Yeah.
Maybe that kind of, there's something more behind it. It's not just a rhetorical gesture. It's not just a way of saying, oh, get on with it. You know, you're making a problem out of nothing. It may be that he had a kind of picture of somehow being at ease in this environment, being at ease in this countryside, of actually the different factions, the different elements in this countryside, beyond the religious schisms, beyond the cultural and racial schisms, there was this possibility of togetherness and this hope for the community. And so I kind of sort of draw a bit of a graph or a bit of a line between the apology, which is very moving, but maybe doesn't completely deliver what he needs, and the sentence of affirmation, which I think does.
You write about,
I keep on talking about that sentence. I wonder if I ought to read it.
I think you should read it, as a matter of fact, because that's how you end the novel. I mean, you write about how Sewell wants to explain to his fellow colonists why it is we've all been so harried by, as you put it, by the fears that they betrayed and destroyed this great enterprise of America. And that's how you end the novel, with that first piece of writing that of Sewell's that first caught your eye. So, yeah, why don't you read it? It's a really long sentence, but it's so lovely.
It is a long sentence. What he does is he goes back to, in his mind and possibly physically, to north of Boston, which is where he spends his adult life, to Newbury, where he was brought up, Newburyport, as it now is called. And he revisits in his mind and in my novel, in the flesh, with one of his daughters. He revisits the place of his childhood, where he used to go to school with his beloved teacher, Minister Parker, and where he did his fishing and all the rest of it. And this is what he says. As long as Plum Island shall faithfully keep the commanded post, notwithstanding all the hectoring words and hard blows of the proud and boisterous ocean, as long as any salmon or sturgeon shall swim in the streams of Merrimack, or any perch or pickerel in Crane Pond, as long as any cattle shall be fed with the grass growing in the meadows, which do humbly bow down themselves before Turkey Hill, as long as any sheep shall walk down upon Old Town Hills, and shall from thence pleasantly look down upon the River Parker and the fruitful marshes lying beneath, as long as any free and harmless doves shall find a white oak or other tree within the township to perch or feed or build a careless nest upon, and shall voluntarily present themselves to perform the office of gleaners after barley harvest, as long as nature shall not grow old and dote, but shall constantly remember to give the rows of Indian corn their education by pairs, so long shall Christians be born there, and being first made meat, shall from thence be translated to be made partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light.
It's Richard Francis. His books are Judge Sewell's Apology and Crane Pond, a novel of Salem. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Bath, England. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.